afternoon. This is our regular meeting time. Or actually, we're 2 hours back. But it's nice to have our House colleagues with us this afternoon for a hearing on revenue options as we open the budget reconciliation process. This is the first step along the way, is hearing from the public on ideas on revenue options. There really are not a lot for the 0103 budget, but the first step for us will be for the House and Senate Revenue Committees, is to move the packages, the borrowing packages, through the legislature, and we'll be doing that later on this week. Okay. Representative Verger, did you have anything, or Representative Scott, that you wanted to add before we begin?
No, other than, Mr. Chairman, I just am very pleased that we're holding the public hearings, and I'm delighted to see this many people here. I hope that everyone who has opportunities and would like to give us input, this is the time to do it, so that we will be better informed about what people think. So I would just like to welcome everyone today.
Scott? Actually, Representative Berger has said it all. I appreciate the opportunity. I'm happy that folks are here, and we will take your testimony and hear what goes. Thanks.
Thank you. Ms. Shepherd, I understand you are with the House committee this morning and didn't get a chance to testify, so if you'd like to go first, we would love to have you.
Chairman Deckert and members of the committee, my name is Ruth Shepherd, and I live in Representative Doyle's district near Turner. I've served on a transit board and a school board, and I worked for the legislature when Oregon Project Independence was designed, and then moved to the agency and administered it, set up the program, and it's seen many changes in it since that time. This is just so you'll know where I'm coming from. I have an answer to those that are now saying, well, what do you want your government to do? It's a very good question, but we've hardly had a shot at it before like we have now. And my context says I want public education, I want public safety, and human services. And if we're going to cut in terms of priority, we ought to protect those, particularly in the future, whenever we can. Also, I want to commend the legislature for taking on this incredible task and showing, as far as we can see, an ability to work where it's really tough with each other. And we appreciate that and hope that Oregonians will do the same thing pretty quickly. I have a license plate that reads GR8ST8. And I'm a fervent supporter of the state of Oregon. Some of these suggestions may well be too late for 0103. But it's my observation that whatever we do on 0103 is likely to have either a direct financial implication or a ripple effect for the programs in 0305. And there may not be time to capture revenues in time to do what we need to do. Last fall would have been better. I represent a lot of people who I've listened to, so these are none of them original with me. And I would say one of the suggestions says very strongly that we do need to consider that a tax break or a tax cut is, in fact, a change in the available revenues that we can't afford this time. There's no justification to decrease that general fund now. A second suggestion is that I'm right there to say it. Use legislative authority, which you have, and responsibility to raise and collect additional temporary tax. If that can be done, I don't know, during this biennium. That would extend beyond 0305, but as soon as possible, that would need to be online, seems to me. We should be providing a means, because I traveled the state a little bit, and I listened to various groups And this comes up surprisingly over and over again. How could we contribute money to that crisis to make a difference? There are probably people who have, in fact, voted for 28 and others who suddenly are realizing what our situation is, finally realizing what our situation is. So I would suggest that we look at a means, that is to say a structure that would make it legal to receive private fund donations ranging from the nickels and dimes of school kids to corporate gifts. That could be donated and, I don't want to say dedicated to the general fund, but that would be fluid and usable for this session. Even if it is clear we couldn't project what revenues would be accrued by such a program, but there's some other spin-offs that might put us in pretty good shape for working together. And they might be a statewide drive organized by nonprofit organizations, including, of course, business leaders. We're all in this together. The term state partnerships in bad times comes to mind. We are Oregonians for Oregon, and maybe we could call such a movement A Million Friends of Oregon. Or we could call it Save Our State. We need to define ourselves probably to the nation now and define ourselves to ourselves as problem solvers who do pull together when our backs are to the wall. The fourth one would be perhaps more feasible and lucrative, and that would be a suggestion to restore the collector positions in the Department of Revenue to recover the significant amount of taxes that are owing to the state before the end of the session. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you, Ms. Shepherd. Next up, is there anyone who traveled over? We have Judge MacArthur. Judge MacArthur and Chuck, I might get this name wrong, Hurlman. And from LOC and AOC, Nikki Whitty.
And with us, Mr. Chair, if we may, Ken Strobeck of LOC.
No way. Yes, bring Mr. Strobeck up. Good afternoon.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Mike MacArthur. I'm County Judge in Sherman County and representing here today the Association of Oregon Counties and the Community Development Steering Committee, along with committee members Commissioner Chuck Hurlman and Commissioner Nikki Whitty. Mr. Chair, if I could ask a question to clarify the purpose of the committee today is to hear revenue ideas about this biennium. Is that correct, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Okay, we will try and limit our comments to those that are pertinent to that subject. If that's what your purpose is,
yeah, feel free to expound a little if you have ideas for 03, 05, or general. But we're trying to keep this as tight as we possibly can.
Thank you. I will, Mr. Chair, and try and be as succinct as possible about these problems that I realize are quite daunting, and I don't envy you your task, and I wish that we could bring more succinct, more developed ideas here. We're working very hard with the Community Development Forum, which are the six, now seven state agencies, and the cities, counties, and ports and special district. We met today talking about these very, very problems, and we will be issuing to you a statement from that forum, which is a set of principles around the investment of some of the resources that you have available. Number one, the bonding authority, which you have both in lottery bonds. This ours is primarily focused on the lottery bonds and in general obligation bonds. And the other would be the criteria for job creation that we the principles we think are important as you make decisions, and hopefully you'll look at those as you make those decisions about where to put those assets that are available to you. We think it's important, our job as county commissioners is to continue to work hard to stimulate the economy, because that ultimately is the result of what brings the resources to make the state provide public services. So we think it's important as a principle that you understand that we don't break down the infrastructure that exists to create those jobs during these difficult budget times. And there's an important piece of that infrastructure I want to speak to specifically today, and that's the video poker receipts that come to counties, 2.5%. And we have a letter here that I'll leave with the staff describing the history of that. And basically the history was in 91 when the, this is where I'd like to get on the record, that the, in 1991 when this video poker was approved by the legislature, there was an agreement between the counties and the legislature that the counties wouldn't operate games. They wouldn't participate in running video poker games. Now, for that, the counties accepted 2.5% of the revenues, which we dedicate to our own economic development efforts, and that's an important piece of our budgets right now. And we've factored in those increases because they've been very quite steady over the years, and so we're using anticipating those revenues to keep positions funded, which leverage dollars to continue to try and create jobs in, you know, all over the state. So I hope you'll remember that. And and that brings up the question, the larger question of preemption in general. There are other sources of revenue that have been preempted from local governments' ability to raise revenues that are within the purview of the state legislature to use, beer and wine tax being another example of that. So we hope that you'll look at some of those other areas where you do have authority, or if you choose not to exercise your authority there, then perhaps consider reauthorizing local governments to use that authority. So I'd like to turn it over at this point to the League of Oregon Cities and Ken Strobeck. Unless, Nikki, did you want to say anything?
No.
Okay. Mr. Chair, that concludes my remarks.
Great. Thank you. Questions?
We thought it might be helpful for you to hear from one county at least on how those funds are spent. And Coos County had a unique opportunity.
We just need to get your name.
Nikki Whitty, Coos County Commissioner.
Yes.
That was a little different than what you would think a county would have recently, and that is the opportunity to buy a fish plant to help that piece of our natural resource industry move forward. And Representative Berger and I had conference calls with the Treasury, with OEDD, everywhere, trying to find a program that would help this move forward. With the questionable revenue stream, meaning that we couldn't really afford any loans. And so we had been setting aside a portion of our lottery receipts each year to build up a major repair and replacement fund for our natural gas pipeline that we appreciate the legislature's previous help with that. But because those funds were there, we were able to partner with the Oregon International Port of Coos Bay, buy the fish plant, form a partnership with a South Korean fish marketing firm and our local fishermen, and created 80 jobs. And within a month of their signing that lease agreement, they made an offer to purchase. So we will get that money back, reestablish our fund, and look for another opportunity. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Chair Deckert and House Vice Chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ken Strobeck, and I'm Executive Director of the League of Oregon Cities. And I wanted to talk just very briefly about some general principles on the issue of raising revenue for the balance of this biennium as well as for the next biennium, and then address a couple of specific items that are listed on the 0103 available one-time revenue sources, just discuss those with you as they relate to local governments in Oregon. And my specific comment is that as you're considering what to do about the state budget picture in the revenue side as well as the expenditure side, I hope that you will keep in mind the state in the state of Oregon does not limit itself just to the budget that's passed out of this building. But it means state as in all of government in Oregon. That means county government, city government, special districts, the state of Oregon. We all serve the same constituents. People who you are elected by are the ones who elect their local city councilors, their local county commissioners. And I would really encourage you to take a look at the actions that you're contemplating in light of the entire picture of the state of Oregon and not feel like, okay, I've balanced the state budget on the backs of the counties and the cities. I've done my job, and it's up to them to fend for themselves. I would hope that whatever you do, you would keep in mind the folks that you represent at all levels and make sure that the decisions that are made here in this building don't create additional hardships in cities and counties that have already been restricted under their fundraising ability by the measures that have been passed by the people, measures 5 and 4750, that really started this local budget squeeze 10 years before it hit the state. You know, during the 90s, the state revenue picture was, every time a new forecast came out, it was $300 or $400 million up instead of $300 or $400 million down. So I'd just like you to keep that in mind as you go through that that exercise, both for this biennium as well as for the next. I know that a lot of people are taking a look at the tax expenditure report, and as I've met with some of you on this offline and talked about this. The last time that book was gone through in detail was when I was sitting in your chair, Mr. Chair, and the 1999 session when we went through that book tax credit by tax credit all the way through from beginning to end to see if there was the political will in the legislature to eliminate any of those or reduce them. I'm sure you know the result of that. After we got through the process of that book, we had a list of five or six that we were able to. They were the very, very low-hanging fruit, you know, it was dragging on the ground practically. And by the time we got through with that process, after it had gone through Ways and Means, we ended up with the bold step of eliminating the fish gleaning tax credit. That was all we could get through the legislature at that time. But on a tax principle basis, it was my belief at the time that that people who propose generally tax credits or tax expenditures, it's such an easy thing to do to say take it off the front end before it even gets into the building, before you even know that it's revenue that you've lost, and then you try to balance the budget, but the pie that you start off with is diminished to begin with, and you really don't even know that it was supposed to be a different size before you got to it. And, you know, the philosophy that you should pay for a program by actually having to write a check through the Ways and Means process, I think is much more, involves much more scrutiny, much more review than just the idea of, well, let's give somebody a tax credit if they will do something that we like, and it comes right off the top and you don't even know it. So I would encourage the committees, both House and Senate, to go back and look at the tax expenditure report in detail. And see what you can. Maybe because of the different situations in the economy, you will be able to find more things that are expendable, things that you don't feel like everybody else in the state of Oregon needs to be paying for. Because every time you have a tax credit, you're really saying to everybody else, "I want you to pay for what I want in terms of a tax credit." So be more diligent in seeing what you can do with that, even considering the idea that I've heard advanced of just taking a percentage off all of them. There's a pretty good sized chunk of money when you look at all of the tax expenditures contained in that book. You could also consider just a sunset on all tax expenditures. That was one of the things that we were able to do in 99 was things that didn't have sunsets. We put on a lot of sunsets just to force review by the legislature. But Wish you luck in that endeavor. Now, I do want to talk just a minute about the other proposals that are on the one-time revenue, and specifically about the cigarette and tobacco tax distribution to cities, counties, and public transit, which is listed as $5.4 million for this biennium and $27.9 for the next biennium. I appreciated Judge MacArthur's comments about the lottery distribution, because I believe that the impact of term limits and the limited horizon that that all legislators have because of the fact that there's been so much turnover, you know, you can't know why decisions were made if you weren't here, if you weren't part of those decisions in the first place. So I appreciated his perspective in reminding the committee that the distribution of lottery money to counties was part of an agreement that was made between the state and the counties regarding who can have a lottery and who can't. And I would remind you that the cigarette and tobacco tax distribution to cities, counties, and the public transit districts has very much the same kind of history. If you look at the sheet that I've given you on a handout, the first cigarette tax in Oregon, remarkably enough, was not passed until 1966. It had been proposed to the voters of Oregon six times between 1926 and 1952 and defeated every time. until the legislature came up with a proposal to tax cigarettes 4 cents a pack, with 2 cents of that going to property tax relief to the state, 1 cent going to cities, and 1 cent going to counties. That was referred to the people. And for the first time in the history of Oregon, a cigarette tax was passed when it included a distribution to cities and counties, to local governments. So that was part of the original deal with a cigarette tax, and that was 1 cent in 1966. Well, as you can see, that represented 25% of the total cigarette tax at that time to cities, 25% to counties. You bring that forward to today, cities are receiving 1.6% and counties 1.6%. We've increased from 1966 a grand total from 1 cent to 2 cents. Meanwhile, the state has gone from 2 cents to $1.28 total cigarette tax, with 4 cents of that being distributed to cities and counties. So I'd encourage you to remember that this was something that was passed by the voters, put into effect, was considered, again, a deal that was made with the state and with local governments. And the part of the 1966 ballot explanation was that cigarette tax would be an additional source of revenue for cities and counties. The Oregonian editorialized that this was a great thing to do because it helps the local budget situation in cities and counties. So wanted to just remind you about that. Another item here that will affect local governments is the Senior Property Tax Deferral Program balance, $4 million for the balance of this biennium. We understand that that's a program that that has seen its ups and downs over time, and frankly, we're not going to raise much of an issue about that. We understand that might be something that you could go ahead and use for the balance of this biennium, recognizing that once people go off that deferral program, then the revenues are collected. It would just be a delay in that collection process. But just to reiterate, Mr. Chair, my concern is that you look at the whole picture, that you not undo bargains and arrangements and contracts, in essence, that were made with local governments in the past. Thank you.
Ken, are you able to speak about the ramifications of the take that we're contemplating on the cigarette tax money?
I do have just a little bit of information. We asked some of our cities if they could let us know what the impact would be if this were to go through. And because cigarette tax is a general fund expenditure, most of that would hit police and fire departments because those are general fund supported funds. So it wouldn't be something like water that's on a user fund basis. I got an email from LeGrand that said it would be about $24,000, cost an additional employee. City of Sheridan would have to cut back one half of a police officer, considering we only have 4 of them. That would be a pretty big hit. City of Hermiston was talking about having lost ground revenues. I can't really quite make out what this answer is, but in the city of Toledo, $2,700 for the balance of this biennium. The other thing about taking it off of this biennium, Mr. Chair, is that cities operate on an annual budget. They have people in place. The budget ends at the end of June. If the cigarette tax for the balance of this biennium were to go away, people would have to fire police officers immediately in order to balance the budget for the rest of the year. And I don't think that's a situation that anybody relishes. I mean, it's not even like saying, well, we have 6 months to plan or a budget cycle to go through for the future. We're talking about pretty much immediate reductions. And as I say, because this is general fund money, it would hit hardest on police and fire.
Committee. Senator Corcoran.
When we were freshmen together, I never knew of his interest in the city's county being so intense.
I thought, Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, I thought we talked about it almost daily.
Thank you. I think that's got it. Mr. Smith from Eugene.
Hello, I'm Jerry Smith, a retired social worker living in 5041 Saxon Way, Eugene. I'm coming to on behalf of so many people with disabilities who cannot come. Friends have been telling me day after day, you know, their disabilities are too severe to get here. I'm coming because of my cousin in North Bend, who lives in senior low-income housing and was cut from the medically needy program February 1st and has already had a major problem with the abnormal blood count. She has heart and lung problems. I'm coming because on Saturday in Eugene, we heard the Lane County delegation took testimony from citizens, and there was among us two people who were badly affected by cuts, including one man who had diabetes and heart surgery and had lost his medications, and his doctor told him Saturday that he had 6 days left. His heart would stop in 6 days if he didn't get medication. So what I'm coming to do is ask you to hurry. There were several things in the mill last week that we thought were inadequate, for sure, but they were triage, you know, where you take care of the worst mess that's out there and don't let people die from the lethal cuts. And we support that triage. We also support whatever you can do. You're foxier. You've got the people here who tell you, you know, what you can scrape out of this department and what out of that department, what you can borrow against, what you can take bonds on. And we urge you to, first of all, triage right away and save the lives like the ones I've mentioned. And secondly, set up a program that that restores the health of state government. There's been no mandate to dismantle government and its programs. I've been here every day, or nearly every day, since the legislature opened, and people whisper to me, "Don't say taxes." Well, that's nonsense. That's a stupid old religion that's long since dead. You know, you have to raise taxes to have a government. You have to raise them here in Oregon. You have to raise taxes from people that have the money to pay it. And your Constitution tells you, in the very paragraph where everybody's quoting, that says that that you can't go into deficit spending, it says you must fund your programs. You know, it's not it's a constitutional requirement, and so get on with it. Find some ways to raise the taxes that are necessary and fund these programs. Why do we need money? Well, first of all, there's been a growth in population, an increase in poverty, and a few years back you said you gave the voters a great relief in property taxes by switching property tax payments from the county into the state income taxes. So integrity requires that you keep your agreements, not drop these greatly needed programs. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Questions or appreciate your time. Mr. Cook and the Carlsons, Mr. and Mrs. Carlson. Mrs. Carlson, please.
Can you?
Not familiar with your environment here.
So pull the microphone over to where
Yeah, perfect.
That's perfect.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Robert G. Cook. I call myself Rob Cook. That's how people in the Oregon Disabilities Commission know me. I'm a new member in the state. I have a pretty large experience in community development, a master's degree in that, rehabilitation for the blind, also another in education. I was invited to become involved with people with disabilities when I moved to Springfield. My wife is also visually impaired. I'm totally blind. We both work in the field while helping organize with other people in this room, a group in the Eugene, Lane County area called Lane Independent Living Alliance, where we take information, advocacy, peer mentoring, independent living skills training, and direction towards employment very seriously. Both in my role as a coordinator for information and services in Lane County Living, the Alliance for Disabilities, and as a commissioner, the increase in number of people that have called me in the last 3 months has been kind of astounding. And since information is something that generally is the fail-safe for a lot of people who kind of fall through the cracks and don't know what to do, the information I'm having to give them at this point is coming so fast from the people in this room that are legislators that all I can do is put good faith forward, which I'm going to express now. I understand that constitutionally deficit needs to be funded, so my naivete is going to be expressed maybe presently when I say that I have no fear in an alcohol increase in taxes. It would be 25 years as I understand it, which is about when the first time I moved to Oregon, when I didn't drink, occasionally drinking now, it wouldn't bum me out to pay a little bit more if I knew that my peers wouldn't be going through loss of medical and health benefits, being in greater jeopardy because of lack of police and adequate care and, you know, paramedical services and such. I think that might be one thing that I know it's not probable at this point for the 0103, but it's something to look forward to, along with the fact that I know the property taxes in this state are, and other taxes across the board, are about 46, I think it was. So I think people in this state, it's time to come up to bat to realize that everybody in this state uses public services. As one legislator said in the Eugene legislative meetings we had this weekend, that only 60% of the people, 60% don't use services, which to me is a naive fallacy. But I would leave it in the legislators in this room to understand that revenues need to go to people. And I think in our state building out front, it says that the benefits should be equilaterally spread across the people of the state. And I think one thing that may be really important is to, in any way possible, maintain the employment for people like the revenue collectors, because if we lose $20 million because of lack of revenue recovery, it's also the people who are paying those taxes, such as revenue, you know, collectors and the police and such, who pay their taxes into our system. It's kind of a catch-22. And myself, I take money. I've written grants in other states, and I still collect that income, pay my taxes on that, pay my own health care to a great extent so that I don't have to be a burden on the state. So speaking in behalf of people with disabilities, I, for one, went to the rehab system in this state early on and in another state to my completion, so that I can be in a position to speak to you about what it's like to be disabled, come up out of the depths of depression, the horrors of living on the street and such, work my way for a short period through benefit systems, and come back to pay into the revenue systems of a state like Oregon, and happily hope that we can find a way as soon as possible to alleviate some of the problems. And so I'm here to just state that I think a tax increase at any level isn't a scary idea if you're willing to work and pay your way in society like I do and many people with disabilities do. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cook. Thank you for taking time out of your schedule to be with us. Thank you.
Hi.
Hello.
So I'm Gwyneth Van Frank Carlson. I live at 33030 Bloomberg Road in Eugene. And I want to thank you all very much for providing this opportunity for us to testify It's been a big desire of ours, and we certainly appreciate it. I also want to say thank you for tomorrow night, because there are several vehicles that are planning to come tomorrow evening for your committee and for the Ways and Means. And as we were told that the meetings would go from 3 to 9 with a dinner break both days, some people that were not able to come until tomorrow evening are very grateful for that opportunity to come. So that quote that's on the wall outside, carved in stone, says, "A free state is formed and maintained by the voluntary union of the whole people, joined together under the same body of laws for the common welfare and sharing of benefits justly apportioned." And to me, that says Oregon, with its great abundance of resources, and I'm not talking the state government coffers at this point, but Oregon and Oregonians share amongst us a huge wealth of resources. And if they are justly taxed and apportioned, there shouldn't be this kind of a problem. According to the Constitution of Oregon, as has been mentioned before, the approved budget, my understanding is that the approved budget must be funded, that revenues must be raised to fund the approved budget. And that 0103 budget was approved, and now instead of raising revenues, there have been program cuts after program cuts. And to me, I know that there are different interpretations of the way the Constitution is written, but I've read it, and it's pretty obvious, so I hope that you guys can find another interpretation rather than cutting programs. I wanted to talk to you about the value of programs and the comment that was made this weekend that 60% of Oregonians don't use services. And actually, I disagree wholeheartedly with that statement. I know there's lots of different pots of money and different ways that money is raised and spent. And to most Oregonians, that's pretty irrelevant. Taxes are taxes. And you put money into the system and you get services back, like roads, like police officers, like education, and all of the people who don't have disabilities and who may make enough money that they can pay $25,000 a year, God forbid, into their tax bill, you know, because they only have $75,000 left. Well, plenty of us can tell them how to live on it, that one-tenth of that. So I don't have a lot of sympathy for somebody who has to pay taxes when they have such benefits as roads and education and public safety. And not to mention, many of the people that I have worked with in my years of doing rehabilitation work are people that once were wealthy, once were what we call temporarily able-bodied. Well, that's our term that we use in the disability world, TAB. People who are temporarily able-bodied don't stay that way. And there are so many stories I could tell you of people who had money, who had a child with Down syndrome, and their money was drained away. People who had money whose husband or wife was stricken ill and unable to work, and the partner had to stop work and stay home to take care of them, because until the mid-80s, this state didn't provide spousal support, so there was no way that a person could get taken care of unless their spouse stayed home, and then they didn't have any money. So they lose their house, they lose all their assets, and thank God there's been a safety net program for people to depend on at that point. When all your assets and resources are gone, there's still been a state safety net. And when I first moved to Oregon in 1978, from Utah, which is a hellhole for people with disabilities, let me tell you, I was absolutely impressed by the progressive climate of independent living and the focus on people who adjusted to their disability by going back to work. And if it wasn't just paying taxes kind of employment, it was community development and independent living training for new people with disabilities, because disability is the only special interest group that anybody can join. And we're all getting older as baby boomers. And, you know, if it's not you today, it could be you tomorrow. And you will want those services to be available. When your old aunt doesn't have any money left in her estate, and is she going to move in with you? Or is she going to move into a nursing home and get the Medicaid that she's been eligible for because she earned it over her lifetime? And that's the thing, that you guys have a responsibility to provide the programs that serve people. So I know you've heard a lot of lectures on principles from me. One of the suggestions I have in terms of revenue raising for this biennium is, I understand the Medicinal Marijuana Fund has about $100 million in it sitting around waiting for a potential lawsuit. I don't know if that's correct, if that's a rumor, you know, one of those
rumors.
Urban legends. Is it a rumor? Can you check?
Mr. Chair, yes, we'll check.
Thank you. So I know that we're here to deal with this biennium, and I just encourage you to please keep these programs. They are so essential for lots and lots of people, and don't just let them lapse this biennium. Oh, here's one thing I've been hearing a lot of people say. Why should we prolong the agony for these people if we're not going to fund the programs next biennium? Why shouldn't we just let them drop dead today? Well, I want to ask you, if it was you on the Titanic and you had your child in your arms and you're waiting for a lifeboat to come back, hopefully, are you going to throw your kid overboard before that lifeboat has a chance to return and save you? Of course you're not. You would want, and if you ask any one of us, and I'm personally not being affected by these cuts, but if you ask any one of the people that I represent whether they would want to be saved for the next 3 months for the hope that they might survive beyond that, they would tell you yes. And if it was your child or your spouse, you would do the same. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Carlson.
I didn't think called that for a long time.
Well done.
Thanks.
Appreciate you taking time out of your schedule to be with us. Mr. Leland Samuelson from Washington County is not here. Well, we'll be back at that concludes our folks who have signed up. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify before the Joint Revenue Committee?
Or like Mr. Bakes does.
Okay. John Radford, if you might take a moment to brief us on your work as the controller
to
produce the capper for us.
You could ask him the question about the $100 million.
Oh, that's true. You might.
Chair Deckard and members of the committee, my name is John Radford. I'm state controller, work for the State Controllers Division, Department of Administrative Services. And Mr. Werner has asked me to talk a little bit about our CAFR document. CAFR is an acronym for Comprehensive Annual Financial Report, and it is a document that is produced annually that summarizes all of the assets, the liabilities, and equities of the state, including summarizes all of the revenues and expenditures for the state. This document is produced from our statewide financial management system, which houses all of the assets, liabilities, equity accounts, all of the funds and ties to the Oregon State Treasurer. And we work with all of the agencies, all the financial officers, all of the state accountants, and we produce this highly summarized financial statement. It is very similar to the financial statements that you might receive in the private sector from various corporations. It is very summarized, very high-level financial statement. You've probably undoubtedly heard of a website called www.caferman.com, and this site is a person that is federally trained in financial accounting, financial reporting, and has gone through the 50 states and produced from those 50 states, each state produces a CAFR, a Comprehensive Annual Financial Report, and he's gone into those CAFR documents and pulled out various trust fund accounts and various restricted accounts and have listed state by state where there's a potential for resources to solve fiscal problems. And you probably have heard of some of the responses put together by the Legislative Fiscal Office staff that indicates that many of these account balances that are out there are either represent either trust funds or restricted accounts, restricted funds, and aren't generally thought of to be current resources, resources that could be appropriated for current programs and services. So with that, I guess I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have, either of the CAFR document or the CAFR process or financial statements or anything else related thereto.
Senator Perry-Ellie.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, if you remember, it was during the orientation of our Senate Revenue Committee that I asked specifically for members of our staff from Legislative Revenue to bring forth the CAFR report, and somebody who could, I think I characterized it as drive a stake through the heart of this urban legend that holds that there are amounts variously from $10 billion to $58 billion located. Actually, the question I have for the witnesses, is there a black X on the carpet in your office behind your desk that says, dig here? Because the persistent rumor is that the state's sitting on between $10 and $50 billion in surplus dollars that are known to be controlled by a small cabal. I've never been able to figure out who that is because it ain't me.
It would be Republican. You can bet on that.
Actually, if it were, I'd actually almost be happy about that. But if you could help drive a stake more thoroughly through this urban mythology and maybe ground out some of this bad energy that we've got.
Chair Deckert and Senator Ferrioli, members of the committee, I can tell you, I asked about this www.caframan.com website with many of my colleagues around the state, and none of them have heard of this website. It seems to be something unique to Oregon. Our CAFR, our Comprehensive Annual Financial Report, two things that I would say about it. One is that in today's environment, given our technology and the new system that we implemented in the 1990s, we have probably one of the most accurate financial statements of financial position and accounting that we've been ever able to produce. This financial document is reviewed by two organizations. First is the Secretary of State's Audits Division, which spends a great amount of time with us, with the agencies, in verifying the accuracy and integrity of the data that's in our financial statements. And they express an opinion. They audit our financial statements. These financial statements are put together, and the entire system is built under generally accepted accounting principles promulgated by the Government Accounting Standards Board. They apply, they being the State Auditors Division, apply generally accepted auditing standards. And they apply those standards in the review of this financial statement and express an opinion. And in that opinion is a positive opinion that the numbers, the summarizations, the calculations, the basis for this financial report is consistent with generally accepted accounting principles and presents fairly a summary of our financial, the results of our financial operations and a summary of our financial position at 6:30, at June 30th of each year. So this is an annual report. The other group that reviews our document and expresses an opinion is the Government Finance Officers Association. This association is comprised of finance officers of the 50 states, 50,000 cities, 3,000 counties, approximately 15,000 school districts. That association has a set of standards that govern the production of a comprehensive annual financial report. Each year we send three copies of this financial statement, of our financial statement, to the Government Finance Officers Association, which allocates that out to other preparers in other communities, large cities, states, counties, school districts around the nation. Those three preparers each independently review the CAFR to determine the compliance with standards and whether or not there are any basis for improvements that we can make. Those three individuals then summarize a report, give it to the Government Finance Officers Association in Chicago, and they send us a certificate of compliance with standards. They also give us a critique of our financial statements and give us ideas about ways we can make improvements. The basis of this, of course, is transparency and accountability, that government is not only accountable for its taxes and its expenditure programs and its revenues, but we also do this in a transparent way. We provide openness and transparency of our financial transaction, and it's summarized in this document. The document also contains disclosures, required disclosures that are set by standards nationally, and those are also audited. So I guess the summary of this is that the document is an accurate and true reflection of our financial condition, the results of our financial operations each year at 6/30, and the trust funds and the restricted accounts that are presented in our financial statements are just that. They're restricted, and they're of a trust nature. And they just, and the other thing that I would mention is that they are all in compliance with legislative and statutory requirements, constitutional or otherwise. So to suggest that there are funds in here that are not being looked at or turned over or considered is just not correct. That this is a document that can be relied upon, it's accurate, and it's a trustworthy document in and of itself.
Mr. Chairman, if I could pursue.
Dr. Allen.
I don't intend to be argumentative because I believe the explanation that you've given. But I really think it's important that we explore this as thoroughly as possible. Enron used to file complicated financial statements that were double audited by independent auditors, too. So the fact that we have a double blind system in the Secretary of State's audit office and independent auditors both saying that the principles on which the report is based meet the standard practice principles for accounting doesn't really tell us that the dollars that are involved in those accounts are held by Oregon primarily in trust or as a hedge against future anticipated expenditures, which they are. So how am I going to assure Oregonians that the audit document and the transmittal letter doesn't relate more to the procedures than it does to the actual empirical data contained in that report? I mean, I want people to be assured that the dollars that are represented by CAFR are, in fact, held in trust against future anticipated obligations, or they are already dedicated and not considered to be surplus to the anticipated need. And how can I give that assurance to people so that I can put an end to this? And let me, before I ask you to answer that question, you said our system is so thorough that it's something unique to Oregon. And I'll tell you, we pump our own gas, we have no sales tax, we have the best land use system, the shortest school year, the highest poverty, the highest hunger, and the most thorough worship of owls and salmon in the U.S. So those are all little unique things to Oregon. But I'm not necessarily, uniqueness is necessarily a benefit to our state. So tell me, this report gives some empirical connection between the idea that these are surplus or trust dollars and not available for general fund use.
Senator Deckett and Senator Ferriola, members of the committee, I can tell you this. The system is constructed based on business rules and logic obtained from the state statutes and constitution. These rules and these controls, if you will, built into the system, in many cases prohibit agencies from making errors or making changes that are not consistent or entering transactions into the system that are not consistent with Oregon laws, rules, and regulations. They just simply cannot do that. Now, that whole control system is also verified by the independence of the Secretary of State's office. We're truly independent from the State Controller's Division and independent from the State Treasury. Those accounts that are contained within those system, within our system, are reconciled monthly with the State Treasurer, who has an independent oversight role on the cash balances and those accounts that are within the State Treasury. So when you have those system of controls and a system of independence there between the State Auditors, the State Treasurer, and the State Controller's Division, it would be very, very difficult for the three of us to get together and collude and to falsify any of the information. It'd be almost impossible. So I would say that the rules that we apply at the national level that are embedded in our system and the controls that are embedded in and the independence between the Secretary of State's office, the State Treasurer's office, and the State Controller's Division may be taken in total, give you a sense of comfort that the data that's contained within this report is accurate and represents reality.
And, Mr. Chairman, finally,
Senator Farrell.
So what you're really telling me is that they don't get into this system unless they've been determined to be revenues that are obligated or reserves that are required for identifiable expenditures. They're connected to an obligation, or they don't get into these reserve accounts.
Senator Deckard, Senator Farrell, and members of the committee, that's exactly right. We have controls and processes and procedures in place embedded into the system and in business operations that prohibit that from happening. These accounts are set up such that we independently account for the assets, the liabilities, and the fund equity for each of these entities in the CAFR.
All right. And Mr. Chairman, let me take this a step further. If we decided for whatever reason to seize and utilize these assets, that would be in contravention to the state law, to state statutes, to administrative rules, possibly the Constitution in certain aspects, but certainly it would put Oregon's bond rating and faith and credit at risk.
Senator Deckard, Senator Farrell, and members of the committee, that's exactly correct. And I'm not a lawyer in this area, but you would have to be connected at the hip with the Attorney General's office before any changes were made. And our system then would follow the law. Whatever the law says, whatever the Oregon statutes or Constitution says, that's what we have to abide by.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Anything further? Thank you very much.
I thank you for not getting into Enron.
Oh, Enron. Anyone else? Any further testimony? Senator Farrioli informs me that the state police has asked us to carry our card keys to dinner with us. We will reconvene this joint committee on revenue for public testimony on revenue options for 0103, though that is somewhat of a misnomer that they are revenue options because they are largely not new revenue. But we will reconvene at 6 p.m. We are adjourned.
Thanks for having me. Controller.